You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author Colleen Kieron, whose debut novel, Feminist on Fire, came out in September from Fomite Press. Colleen Kieron has worked as a vocational and crisis counselor, a teacher, and an animal rights activist. She has a master's degree in writing from Goddard College, and her fiction and nonfiction have appeared in PIF magazine, Eclectica, and All Things Girl. She lives in Montpelier. Feminist on Fire tells the harrowing story of Pam Kieron, a founding member of the radical feminist group The Feminists, active in New York City during the 1960s and 1970s. She wrote Man-Hating and co-wrote Rape, an Act of Terror. Both of these essays were widely anthologized and translated. Pam was an abused child, later diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. For the last 25 years of her life, she lived in homes for adults with mental illness. Feminist on Fire is a mosaic of memories that travels freely back and forth through time and is based on the recollections and research of the author, her niece. Although Pam was healthy at times, her illness was an ever-present impediment to her extraordinary potential. When I spoke with Colleen Kieron, I asked her to begin by sharing early memories and impressions of her aunt, Pamela Kieron, whose life inspired the novel Feminist on Fire.
She was the one adult in my life, as I remember her, who actually seemed to pay attention to what I had to say and be interested in what I had to say. And she was particularly interested in women and young girls, and spoke very openly about that and about wanting to encourage me in any, you know, anything I wanted to do. So she was very supportive, and she was younger than most of the other adults I knew.
Right.
She was born after my, you know, like 11 years after my father was born. So.
Okay. And how did you decide to write about her?
It was after she died, I started to think about writing about her life, and she had a very interesting life, but it also, what really interests me was trying to tell it through her perspective, and I sort of came to that. I didn't start out with that idea, but I wanted to try to present the internal life of someone who has a mental illness. Mm-hmm. I've also worked with people with mental illness a lot, and it's very isolating, and it seemed like a subject that would be interesting to explore to see if it was something people could understand or have empathy for.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you say how isolating it was, because I felt like you did a really good job of depicting that without leaving us in the narrator's head all the time. You know what I mean? Which was, mm-hmm. I think, something that as I read it, it struck me how hard that would be, you know, to both let us see how alone she was and also let us see her whole world in a engaging way. You chose the first-person narrative point of view, and I'm wondering if you... Did you always have it be first-person? Did it just come out that way, or did you play around with things?
It just came out that way. I did think about it a long time before I actually sat down to write it. So when I was thinking about it, I wasn't thinking about it in first person. But when I actually sat down, the first chapter was the first chapter that came to me. Mm-hmm. Because I had visited my aunt in her tiny little Greenwich Village apartment, which really was the size of this living room, maybe even not as big, right. You know, with a bathroom off it and a taped-in kitchen, sort of. And just her life there was so... She just never had any kind of function when she was there, so it was a mess. And she couldn't really take care of herself very well. And I used to wonder what it would be like to wake up day after day in that kind of little, you know, chaotic box that kind of mirrored, I guess, what was going on, you know, in her interior life as well.
Yeah.
So that's how it started, and then it just sort of followed through like that.
Yeah. Did it come easily?
No. Mostly because it was she had just died when I started it. And, you know, like all people when you're younger, you know, and I get to that a little in the book. When you're younger, you're more open to people and empathic. And the older I got, the more I withdrew from her, which was very, you know, I think it was she despaired over that. And then when she died, you look back and you're like, that's too bad I had to do that. And
right.
That I couldn't have been a more open person.
Early in the book, we are introduced to her childhood. She was the victim of emotional and some physical abuse at the hands of her mother, who I suspect also suffered from mental illness. You know, the picture of her in the book, it makes that pretty clear. And also from her father, who was passive and unhelpful, even though he did love her in his own way. But some of these passages were so moving to me. And I was wondering if you would mind reading a little bit, and then we could talk about it?
Sure. Reveille. Next to the small bathroom sink, there is a giant bottle of Jergens hand lotion. It is shaped like a tear, and the smell clings not only to the bathroom air, but all the air on the second floor, because my mother has a bottle in her room, too. The smell is sharp, it's white, the white of buried silence, or bathwater running forever and ever. The sink is blue. It matches the blue of the blue and black tile floor. There is a small window way up above the tub, long and very narrow. There is no sun this morning, so everything inside looks flat. My nightdress is hiked up, and the floor is cold against my legs and feet. Drops of water, the size of pinpricks, sweat on the exposed plumbing. It is early, before my parents have gotten up, but they are awake. I can hear them laughing. This is what they do on weekend mornings. Soon my father will come in to use the bathroom. If he catches me before I've had a chance to get back to my room, he will ask if I've slept here, angrily. He'll say it's silly, and I'll catch a draft. When I say nothing but scooch closer to the toilet, he will yank my arm and yell at me to stop it now. He speaks softly, so my mother won't hear him. But sometimes she catches the edge of his whispering voice and yells from the bed. We both listen and watch her arrive from down the dark, narrow hallway and into the small bathroom entrance, leading with her chest. She knocks my father out of the way and grabs me by the hair. When she pulls my hair out, the pain is like a burn and it lasts for days. Once when it was right in the front, my father kept me home from school for 3 days, and he took off work. My mother said, "Do what you want, I'm going to work." And we sat together in the kitchen and he sang to me, "Ireland must be heaven because my mother was born there." He gave me a fireman's carry up and down the basement stairs while he washed the clothes. My father and I don't talk about the hair or the bathroom. He used to ask me more about why I slept in there. Now he just tells me not to. I know the nights when my mother is going to come into my room. Earlier downstairs, there's something about the way she tells me to go up and get ready now. Her eyes, maybe? When I'm not in my room, she goes back to bed like she forgot what she was going to say. But if I'm there, the door cracks open and shut. She stands in the dark whispering so that my father won't hear her. Just like he doesn't want her to hear him. But I have to listen. She will kill the three of us one night, but she won't say which one, with gas or knives. The smell of hand cream sticks in my nose and throat.
Thank you so much. That is your narrator, Pamela Kieran, who was your aunt. And so her parents would be your grandparents.
Yes.
Do you remember them?
I do,
yeah.
Yes.
Were they kind to you?
They were kind to me. They did not like my younger sister that much. So they chose favorites. They thought I favored their family in terms of my coloring and that I was less like my mother. I know, all this kind of primitive stuff. But they were only nice to me till I was about 7 years old. And then they decided they didn't like my mother or the two daughters, and they just liked my father, and they had to put up with us.
Wow.
Very strange.
So what did you know for sure about Pamela's childhood, and how is it that you come to know what you are sure of?
Most of it is things she told me, and that I heard through different family members.
Mm-hmm.
It's another one of those things in our culture, I would suspect, even in present-day culture, that people suspect that a child is being abused, but they don't really want to say anything, or they don't know how to say anything. And in the 50s, that was probably, you know, that kind of silence was even more encouraged and accepted. And so I did hear things through the family. Everyone in the family was afraid of my grandmother. And, you know, my father and his older sister both left the family as early as they could. They went into the Navy and the convent to get away from her. I mean, it's so heartbreaking and interesting and everything else that they found these institutions to substitute as parents, basically.
Yeah.
And she was left there alone with them because she was much younger than them.
So sad.
And I definitely do know my grandmother was violent. I've seen her violent toward my grandfather in particular.
Okay. I wonder if you can talk about researching the history of a person who might not have had a lot of public records to draw on. Pamela wrote a couple of noted papers. She wrote one called Man-Hating, and she co-wrote one called Rape, an Act of Terror. Both of these essays were widely anthologized and translated, and when I was looking for information on her, I found a lot about those. But and she also gave at least one fiery speech for the feminists.
She did.
Which we can talk about in a minute. But I'm guessing there's not a lot about her on the internet. So
there isn't.
Was it hard?
It was, yeah. I ended up contacting Barbara Mayerhoff, who was the woman she co-authored Rape, an Act of Terror with. And
okay.
She still lives in New York and teaches. She was teaching at Columbia for a while, and now I think she works for the Department of Education. So it was interesting to talk to her. I've talked to her a number of times, and you know, about the kinds of things they did do. They did a lot of direct actions that weren't really publicized or documented. It's not like now where we just take along our cell phones and tape them.
Right.
So, you know, it's sort of word of mouth. Like, they did go into these, you know, Times Square was the Times Square of the 70s.
Right.
So they would go into these pornographic stores and stand right next to men and try to make them uncomfortable and confront the real woman in front of them as opposed to the one,
yeah,
you know, in the magazines. And they did picket the Marriage License Bureau in Manhattan, to say that, you know, marriage was an oppressive institution. And there were all these different factions among the larger feminist group, and they were kind of an anti-pornography, anti-man,
right,
faction, that really wanted there to be, you know, my aunt used to talk to me a lot about the matriarchy and wanting that to come into being again.
Yeah. It is so interesting to read this book and think about what overlaps now from then, but also how much has changed and where we're putting our focus as far as civil rights go. And all right, one chapter in the book covers an abortion rights rally, mm-hmm, at which Pamela gives a speech. And it might have been the height of her power as an individual and as a woman, that speech, contributing to feminism. I mean, maybe the papers too, but she feels quite empowered up there talking. I wondered if you had the actual speech to draw on, and I also wondered how it was for you to try and recreate this moment for her in her life. And I know that it was also, she was under the influence of some drugs and things at the time, but I wonder if you can just talk about writing that moment.
Sure. I did not have the actual speech to draw on. I knew that she had given speeches, and I knew just from knowing her for, you know, 40 years, the kinds of things that were important to her,
mm-hmm,
in terms of abortion rights. And like I said, I think the matriarchy makes an appearance in that speech. And also, you know, genital mutilation, like the things that she saw as things that needed to be addressed immediately. That was all fictional, and so was there's a woman named Rebecca Street.
Okay.
In it, the African American,
yes,
woman. She,
right,
is fictional. You know, there are other historical figures who are obviously real. I know my aunt worked a lot with Susan Brown Miller. Mm-hmm. I don't believe she ever worked with Bella Abzug. You know, so some of that's definitely like just historical fiction. And
right. So did you write that one speech as sort of symbolizing a period in her life where she was doing more than one of these things?
Yes. Okay. I did. Okay. I did. Yeah. In fact, I read a Village Voice article, that may have been the one you read, about a speech she gave.
Oh, okay.
And in that one, she was likening married women to prostitutes.
Okay.
And, you know, like paid prostitutes. And it sounded a little like the Village Voice writer was a bit scandalized by that.
By what she said?
Yeah.
And it's interesting, too, because later in the book, the way that lesbians will, you know, be even more vocal about what they think, about what she thinks, and about what her earlier stage of the movement thought.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, all of a sudden she's like out of date, and
yeah.
It's very strange.
It is,
but,
yeah.
That was hard to read too. So after she finishes her part of the speech in that scene, she listens to the other speakers. Mm-hmm. And do you mind if I read a couple lines?
No.
So during Bella Abzug's speech, Pammy thinks, "I realize that I am not in the flat and airless space I normally occupy. I tell myself to remember how this feels. I wonder if other people feel this way in general, more integrated with people in space and time, less abstract. It would explain why most people don't wonder if they should kill themselves every day. Ha ha." I wonder if you can talk about the experience of writing about a progressive mental illness, which you mentioned a little bit, and trying to recreate it as you put together a composite of her life.
Yeah, I felt... Well, another thing about mental illness is in working with mentally ill people and having my aunt to deal with from such an early age, you know, children are, as we all say... you know, they're smarter than you know, and although I idolized her, I always knew she was different. And I think for people with mental illness, that feeling of difference informs everything they do.
Mm-hmm.
And they never feel, I mean, another thing is it's all on a continuum. So some of this isn't like that wildly foreign to me. Like
right.
I've had periods in my life where I'm like, you know, what is it, you know?
Right.
Like, I hate getting up, I hate my life. And just sort of having a vision through someone you love or people you work with into what if your life was only ever that?
Yeah.
You know, like, how demoralizing, how do you pick yourself up
yes.
all the time if that's all you know? And you know, in this, like, this little window she had into being a functioning person and thinking, oh, that's why other people don't always want to kill themselves. You know, like,
right.
they have these other experiences. And, you know, being in your 20s and not even realizing
yeah.
that other people are not having that same grim life.
Now, you mentioned being able to relate because we all go through these times and how it would be if that's all your life was. I'm wondering, and you also mentioned before about feeling badly after she died for the fact that you reacted, I think, in a very human way by withdrawing and finding her a little bit shocking sometimes and not maybe engaging with her in the way you would have liked. So is there an aspect of this book that is an apology or is a... That's probably the wrong word, is an acknowledgement of there before the grace of God, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I remember when I was younger, and you know, I think when we're all younger, we have more of a stomach for you know, like I'd watch Sophie's Choice and love it, and, you know, watch it again, and
yeah.
Apocalypse Now, and, you know, and then as you get older, they're all so upsetting.
Right.
Like, you know, I don't know that I want to watch that or if I'm up to that, and... You know, it strikes me that my experience with my aunt it was like that to some extent. When I was younger, I was better able to embrace her and not be as dragged down by it.
Yeah.
And as I got older and was struggling with my own problem.
Yeah, life.
Yes, life. It was harder and harder to interact with her and not feel just totally, you know, like slayed by the end of it.
Right.
And I do feel bad. You know, I always admire those people, like, you know, my friend who works with the Humane Society, who can kind of be above all that and not look at the situation, but at the larger arena and say, you know, I'm going to be this better person because this person needs this help instead of how it's infecting me. But I'm not that strong all the time.
So,
you know, it's hard.
Absolutely. Structurally, the book is set up in a series of short moments in time. And they're not chronological moments. And I wondered as I read them if you were trying to pattern them sort of within Pammy's mindset. She had been diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. And I just wondered if I'm reading too much into this structure or if that was part of your reasoning.
Oh, yeah, it was part of my reasoning, yeah. A mind that's been so damaged by life and drugs and, you know, prescription and otherwise, I don't know that they can, after a while, that the coherence in their lives is not what it is for a lot of us. I think also, which, you know, that's in the book too, when you don't have a job, as much as I've disliked some of the jobs I've had in my life, but it does ground you to something.
Right.
You know, if you have a job or kids or whatever, all these things in our culture that kind of, you have a little, these things you have to do.
Right.
And when you don't have that, and you also have a mind that's very ill, you know, I think you're sort of this nebulous being. You know, you don't have that that through line or that, you know, the narrative in a way.
Right.
Or not a normal, what we think of as a narrative progression.
Right. Some of the narrative involves Pammy's work for the feminists, which we've talked a little bit about. How much did you know about this group as you began writing this, and how much were you able to learn through research? And I know you said you talked to Barbara, her friend.
I did. I read a number of books where Pam and Barbara and the feminists were referenced. And I also searched high and low for she did. That part was based on fact. Pam did appear on David Frost.
Right, and you couldn't find that?
I couldn't. Well, they said it was like CBS, I think. They said they could do a search for me, but it would be like $2,000, whether they could found it or not.
Wow.
Like, just initiating that search cost
that much money. Probably they only do those searches usually for like another station or somebody who wants to.
Yeah.
Wow, that's
so cool. I ended up not doing that. But I, you know, as I keep an eye as to what's being released, like on streaming or, you know, video and DVDs, just to see if David Frost ever is released. I mean, I guess it would take a number of weeks to go through them all.
But yeah. He was on for years, right?
Probably? Yes, he was. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that would be great to see, though. She didn't have a copy of it.
No.
No. And they didn't have Betamax
in
1970, whatever.
They didn't have anything. No, it seems that way now, but yeah.
One thing I found really interesting was the schisms within the feminists, the groups within the group. At one point, Pammy considers the fact that pretty women are separate. You wrote, Mary Lee and Janice are both very pretty. I've tried to train myself not to notice or think about how women look, but beauty is something the world appreciates and rewards. These women are nice to look at. It's as if intrinsic to their beauty is certain favor for and toward them. That just struck me. And then another moment was at the same rally that we just discussed, an African-American woman, or Afro-American in the language of the time, and you just said that this was a fictional character, Rebecca Street. She gets up and speaks and requests inclusion for all women, no matter class or color, in the rank of the feminists. And she makes a really good case that black women were not at that time actively welcomed or enlisted. And actually, it reminded me a little bit of the Bernie Sanders rally, where those two African-American women got up and sort of surprised this liberal audience by suggesting that the Black Lives Matter movement was not really adequately represented by liberal politicians. Not a priority. So I wonder what are your thoughts on the challenges that these women faced in the 70s in trying to create a cohesive movement?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's called the Second Wave, and it was, you know, it was the inception of this, and while some of the thinking was very sophisticated, especially for that time in terms of gender politics, the race politics and the socioeconomic politics just wasn't there. And I think most feminists, when looking back, will say that now.
Right.
You know, even my aunt, I mean, a lot of this I got from her and from just reading about, you know, the movement at that time and some of the criticisms against it.
What was her reaction at the time? Did she see it or did she feel like it was being overstated?
She definitely felt like it was being overstated, particularly with the lesbians, which is why I had that scene in there. That was how she felt at that time. I think if she had lived longer, she would feel differently about that now and be able to look back like she did on the race issue and say, you know, there were things we missed and that we just didn't get at that time. And, you know, but the woman, Rebecca Street, though, while she's not based on a real character in my aunt's orbit at that time, there was a woman in, when I was at Old Dominion University, I took a Women in Cross-Cultural Perspectives class, and this was a African-American visiting professor from Yale. Mm. And there was a mix of black and white women in the class, and I remember one class, she looked at us all and she said, we can all sit here and talk about men and, you know, trash them, and everyone enjoys that. But I'd like you to challenge you to think about race and socioeconomic backgrounds. And the whole class just went silent, because here are these young black and white women, you know, who hadn't really thought about those issues, or not in a way to make them uncomfortable and admit that there were, you know,
issues.
Differences and issues.
Right, because up until then in that room, they felt like they were on equal footing as far as these opinions.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely interesting. And she brought up some, I had another, a black politics teacher who was also, you know, he used to talk about, I mean, just, it's, you know, some people have said this lately with the Black Lives Matter movement, just talking about these things, you know, instead of pretending they don't exist.
Or pretending they're fixed.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
You know, we've had a black president, everything's better.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and just, you know, trying to, among ourselves even, to say, yeah, let's look at this, and why do we do that? Like, why are we exclusive like that?
And right. You include in the book some letters that Pammy writes to her brother, Charlie, whom I'm guessing is your father.
Yes.
So did you have access to actual letters, or did you find this a way to vary the narrative and include family history without being just sort of in her head?
I didn't have the actual letters. I knew that she wrote to him.
Okay.
And I knew that she claimed to have written to him when she was young, asking him for help. And he was in the Navy and overseas by that time.
Right.
And she, when she told the story to me, it was, oh, he never got back to me. And when I asked my father about that, he said, I never got a letter like that.
Oh, that's interesting.
But it's another interesting postscript is my father, I didn't tell my parents about this book until recently. And, you know, my father was like, of course, I'm fine with that. Send it, blah, blah, blah. And my mother was a little more apprehensive. So I sent them copies and, my mother has been delighted, and she even got on the phone. She's like, well, I'm Eileen, right? And I'm like, yeah, you're the drunk mother. And my father has been much more quiet on the subject.
Interesting.
And he said, I said, well, was it really hard for you to read? And he said, it really was. He said, there's some things I don't think I've thought about for, you know, like 50 years. And I didn't present, I don't think I presented it like that, but he was to blame, or Janet. They were, you know, or the sister and brother, they were kids themselves. And I said that to him. I said, it's not presented in that way. And he said, no, it's just hard to, you know that she was there. And I knew my mother was violent. He said she used to hit me, but I got bigger and bigger, and I would just laugh at her and walk away.
Right. Yeah. So. Well, and, you know, that's he's entitled to his reaction, and he probably...
No, absolutely.
You know, it's probably, in its own way, more of an endorsement of the book that he takes it seriously and that it affected him, right?
Yeah.
Rather than just sort of like, oh, yay, I'm Charlie.
Yeah.
You changed certain names, and you didn't change Pammy's name.
That's true.
And why?
I guess because she's deceased at this point, and it just seemed easier to, you know, my parents are still alive. I am.
Yeah.
Even though I know everyone knows, you know, who the players are.
Yeah.
It just seemed, since she had passed, that was okay to use her name.
And the aunt who went into the convent?
Yes.
She's still alive. Has she read it?
No.
Does she know about it?
She does not. She does not. She has dementia at this point,
okay.
So I'm not even sure, like,
right,
how much she would
process it.
Yeah.
Have you sent it to any of the women that are represented in the feminists?
Barbara Meyerhoff has a copy.
Okay.
And very early, as you know, because that was my initial spark to do more with this, I sent it to Susan Faludi, who really liked it.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
But no one else that I know of.
And T. Grace?
T. Grace Atkinson. She doesn't have it, although that's an idea.
She's still around.
She's still around, yeah.
Okay.
She is. Yeah.
Okay. I want to talk about man-hating.
Okay.
The essay and
sure,
maybe the subject. This is a quote from Pamela's essay, Man-Hating. All arguments which tend to suppress the recognition of man-hating in our midst are reducible to this, fear. Man-hating is a subversive and therefore dangerous sentiment. Men who control definition have made of it a disgusting perversion. We've been unable to get out from under their definition. I've been at meetings where women actually left because they thought the man-haters were on the loose. One woman talked to me in awe and disgust about a woman who she felt had made an anti-male statement at a meeting. It has been the cause of a deep rift within women's liberation. It is a vital issue because it involves ultimately the way we feel about ourselves and how far we are willing to go in our own behalf. It's funny. I remember, I was very young, as were mm-hmm. you, when a lot of this stuff was going on. And I do remember it just being incredibly contentious that women were standing up and saying this stuff. And it's been reframed now, you know, mm-hmm. feminism has been reframed. Did you grow up, as a result of her influence, did you grow up with a lot of these feelings and thoughts about what was acceptable as far as, like, rejecting men because they were misogynists and because our culture has so subverted women? Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, I grew up, I had my aunt as an influence, who, despite her, you know, her pontificating on this subject and talking about man-hating and very much so normalizing it, like saying this is a kind of natural response, it's probably through other women in my life that I grew to fear and also hate men, you know, that I've had come to terms with, because I don't want to hate anyone, but as, you know, especially when I was younger, I think it was through my mother and some of her friends. It was an odd little culture, these Navy wives who were mostly British
mm-hmm.
and uneducated. And
your mother's from Scotland.
She is, and
yeah.
married these American men, and felt very infantilized by them, I think. And it was, you know, again, it's the age, the cultural moment. And also my mother, you know, from a very early age, I think she developed early, her breasts, and she was harassed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And she sort of, you know, passed down a lot of this fear of men to my sister and I. I got it more from other women than I did from my aunt necessarily, who is very sex positive, as they say, even though she goes on to reveal some very kind of shocking and sad things about her sex
right.
life. But she was very sexual, especially in the early 70s, and liked to talk about sex and how women should enjoy sex. I guess the patriarchy, to her was this kind of a oppressive institution.
Right. It's funny to me, or I guess maybe it's sort of natural to me, looking back over
yeah.
history, that there would be a movement of, like, it's okay to hate men. They
yeah.
have been suppressing us for centuries.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and actually I love this footnote. There's a footnote in her paper. It's interesting that while the Greeks had a word for both man-hating and woman-hating, only the latter has been anglicized and incorporated into English. So misogyny is a word that still exists, but she says the likely word would be misandry. Okay. And I looked it up, and actually there is a word misandry, but we don't know that word. It's not part of our conversation. That was so interesting to me because there is a word for woman hating.
Yeah.
But we're all shocked
to hear
that anyone should say that there should even be a sensibility of man hating, right?
No, it's true.
It's just interesting.
It's true.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just remember also going out with this, you know, someone I didn't know very well with a group of people and him talking about seeing Spike Lee at UVM.
Okay.
And he was kind of shocked that Spike Lee was angry. You know, and
really?
And I was kind of shocked that he was shocked. And, you know, to
really?
Me, it's like, you know, I don't know, anger doesn't... it seems like a normal expression, and in our culture, it seems like something you're not supposed to really talk about.
It's not polite.
It's not polite.
It wasn't polite when Miles Davis turned his back on his audience.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But it does make you go, huh.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's an uncomfortable feeling, but it is a feeling, and I think people have a right to it, and I do think it can be, as she says in one of her speeches or papers, in my book, it can be a positive force. I don't see it just as a negative force.
Right.
And I think a lot of people do. You know, I love Spike Lee's films and his anger and his, and I think he has a right to it, and the, you know, oppressed groups do. What are...
Sure.
It's not like they're happy about
You're
it.
You're not going to change anything by being happy.
No.
Right?
No.
Or by being accepting or, you know.
No.
If you don't mind, I want to read a couple more statements from the book. These are, to me, linked statements. This is Pammy. I think she's probably in her 20s here. I'm trying to remember what section this is from, but okay. There are whole years of my life I don't remember. The year I lived with Barbara I remember, but I'd rather not. That's what I said to Dr. Tukek. It's like it was a mistake, a time when I thought not only could I change my life, but the lives of all women. It was my certainty that is painful to remember. All right, and then a little bit later, there's a scene that takes place between Mia and Pammy, Mia being your character. Pammy is in the depths of depression, and Mia is seeing her during the holidays. She's a teenager. The whole family is together downstairs, but Pammy is up in bed very ill. Okay, so this is the bit I want to read. Mia places the plate and cup on a dresser drawer. She looks out the third floor window, opaque with frost etchings, a primitive accounting scratched into the glass. She reaches a fingernail to the pane and scrapes. I've told my parents I need to speak to them about this, she says. We're going to go see George and Mary tomorrow night after dinner. I'll do it then. I can tell she is certain that her words will help for having been spoken. I loved that. And just this echoing of the fact that in our youth, there's a certainty that everything's going to get better. You know, and I remember that in my own life, too. It's like, well, my generation's going to fix everything, of course. And there's this power behind our intention that we haven't yet discovered won't necessarily get things done. So anyway, I loved those two linked moments, or they were linked for me when I read it. So I just wondered, does Mia, I'll just put it in the third person here, does Mia see Pammy in herself and in this moment? And actually, in the next moment, something happens that kind of drives a little bit of wedge between them, which was painful. Anyway, I just wonder if you can talk about writing that scene, particularly the second scene that's between me and Pammy both.
Yeah, well, I definitely thought, you know, first Pam when she was young and then Mia, like you say, you have this conception of yourself, and Pam says that about Mia later on in the book, as the world just waiting for you to come and do your thing.
Yeah.
Instead of you arriving in the world and being sort of dwarfed by this huge world.
Right.
You know, it's this shift in perspective in your late teens into your mid-20s that's like, oh, you know, I can't just say things and make a big change, you know. And And I did, so the scenes that I depict with my Aunt Pam and I did happen. They're large, I mean, I was there for them, so
right,
I can,
yeah.
You know, they're fictionalized still, but they did happen. And I did tell my parents, and I did think it would make this huge difference. Like, now we know what's wrong with Pam,
mm-hmm.
and now we can help her.
Right.
And it didn't really.
Right. Everybody already knew what was wrong with Pam.
Everyone already knew.
And they'd already made their choices about what to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I was younger, and I'm writing about that now, you know, I ended up when I was 11 telling my parents about a little girlfriend of mine who was being incested by her grandfather. And that stopped. My parents went to her parents immediately and told them. And he was never allowed to see her again.
Mm.
However, he was never arrested. And he was a headmaster at a school in Great Britain.
Huh.
So he went on to molest who knows how many other little girls. And then they just kept asking him to leave schools in Great Britain. And he eventually moved to Canada.
Wow.
And did it there.
Wow.
So
he was never stopped?
Never stopped. So while, you know, my words had some power in this immediate situation with my girlfriend, my little friend.
Right.
The fact that as I got older, I realized nothing ever happened. There was never any other consequence to him that made him stop that behavior, you know.
Yeah.
You know, all of those things were kind of, when you realize that, it's not an easy thing to have to face.
Right.
That you can do the right thing or try to do the right thing and still nothing really comes of it or not what you expected.
All right. I was going to ask you to read one more thing. The second half of this page.
When Mia was a teenager, she and I knowingly quoted Artaud to each other, not realizing how much we meant this and what that might mean for our lives. Not that it has meant the same thing to each of us, the delineation being that Mia functions in the world and I do not. I stopped and Mia continues. I am a mentally ill person. I will never be a lawyer or a teacher or a writer. It has been years since any of this was even possible. Don't ask me anymore. It was a relief to say this. I was 43, Mia 23. In the intervening 20 years, there has been the weekly phone call, not always as uneventful as they are now. There have been times when she's boycotted me and hasn't called for months, saying I'm verbally abusive, and other times when I couldn't speak or would sob. There are limits to what I can expect of people, and Mia, who wishes she was never born, probably has more limits than most. There's always love in her voice when we speak, but it's shot through with disappointment and disgust. The well person calls the ill one out of love. I would prefer her friendship.
Mm. The only reason I ask you to read that is I thought that was such an incredible encapsulation of what each of you was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
In your relationship, and I mean, just from the creative process, it was just a really great section of history and dialogue, and showing what two people are thinking, even though you've only got one narrative point of view to do it in.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought that was interesting.
Thank you.
Okay, so another overwhelming topic in this book is Pammy's mother. We've talked about her a little bit, your mm-hmm. grandmother. We learn very quickly to despise her.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's pretty clear that she's not quite right.
Ill herself, yes.
Ill. She's got an ISD-9, I was thinking. Is that
yeah.
the right word?
Yeah.
So this is a quote from one of those sections. My mother is solicitous toward my friends. On the rare occasions when she and I are alone these days, she says things like, I know things have been hard for you, Pammy, because you are so smart and shy. It's a disease. Do you know that? I read that once. She has recast herself and me in some other story. That was such a change in her personality, but it was a moment where I began to feel like she was at least trying. Or maybe she was trying to hang on to Pammy and, mm-hmm. and keep her under her control. But I wondered, just generally, did you have increasing or decreasing empathy for her as you wrote the novel?
Increasing. And my grandmother was another person I saw as, thwarted by her gender and her cultural moment.
Sure.
I think my grandmother and my mother as well are women that maybe didn't want to have children and get married. And, you know, we have those choices now. And they didn't. And I think they, you know, my grandmother had other issues, I'm sure. But part of it was, I think, not being a mother.
Right.
And here she is a mother and resenting that. And, you know, and then, you know, she grew up during the Depression and the war, and she came from a 13 sibling family, and
wow.
I think life was very tough for her. And, you know, I think for a lot of women, they never, and men too, I mean, there are plenty of books about that, so, but, you know, just being shunted into this role that you don't fit.
Right.
I'm sure that does produce a lot of mental illness, and
yeah, definitely. I was going to ask what you have read lately that you've enjoyed.
I'm reading right now. I just finished The Confessions of a Carnivore. I want to get the by Diane Leffer.
Oh, right.
And then after I finish that, I ordered Diane Leffer's California Transit, which is a collection of stories. And I'm so excited I've known of Diane Leffer for years because she used to teach at Vermont College, but have never read her, unfortunately,
yes,
until now. And just love her writing and her subjects. You know, they're very different, and very different from my writing in some ways. It's not at all interior or that's not the prominent feature
right.
about it. It's
yeah.
very much of the world and of this particular stance and perspective on the world of caring and wanting to make a difference.
Yeah.
And seeming to be able to be optimistic doing
right.
that.
Right. Which is amazing.
It is amazing.
Because her books all come at it from the angle of things are really broken.
Yeah.
Right? But
yeah.
that optimism is amazing. Yeah.
It really is. It really is. And I did also recently read a book called The Guardians by Sarah Manguso. And she calls that an elegy, which is something I guess I could call this to my aunt, to a very troubled friend of hers who jumped in front of a train New York City to kill and killed himself. That's very beautiful and also very much like this. It's not told in a linear fashion. There's not a plot and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of big books, my father kept imploring me to read All the Light We Cannot See.
Mm-hmm.
And I finished that about 3 weeks ago. I thought that was really beautiful.
It was, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Really, when I read something like that, it's so foreign to how I write and just so intricately plotted and... I'd love to incorporate
right,
more of that.
It's interesting because your book and that book have very short present tense
yeah.
chapters that are
true.
That are, moving around in a story and putting together a whole arc through these snapshots.
Yeah, that's true.
Just different stories.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, I enjoyed that too.
Yeah, he must have enjoyed hearing that you liked it.
Yes, he did. He did. Well, for years my father didn't read fiction.
Oh.
He just read history.
Oh, okay.
And was very intent on that.
Mm-hmm.
And now that he's retired, he's reading fiction. So it's very exciting.
Yeah, that's neat. And what are you writing these days?
I am writing... I call it my Goddard novel. And
okay.
I think anyone who's ever read versions of it calls it my Goddard novel. So I'm revising a novel that I actually first submitted for publication to Fomite Press, who ended up publishing Feminist on Fire. And, was told they really loved parts of it, but really wanted some changes. And interestingly enough, I got some other feedback from an agent saying almost the exact same changes she would recommend.
That's great.
It is.
When
it's nice to have that kind
yeah.
of confirmed. So I am in the process of revising that now. And yeah, that's kind of exciting too. Especially, it would be fun to have something published set at Goddard, seeing I went there and I live in Vermont.
And you used
so
to
many
teach
of us.
There, right?
I did, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. We spoke on the show once before. You were in my 100th show, where I spoke with four emerging yet unpublished writers who I knew personally and respected. It's funny to me, at the time I remember thinking that that show was like a huge thing because it was my 100th show, and now we're at almost my 400th.
Wow.
You might be like 390. No. No, not quite. But anyway, okay. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your experience with getting published and things that have happened to you in the interim as far as your career in writing.
Well, it's been very interesting. Just because I think a friend of mine said this best, to have a book out there and have people react to it in ways that are very unexpected to you anyway.
Right.
Or take things away from it that you weren't expecting, or all of that's it's a little unbalancing. I wouldn't say it's unpleasant or a negative. It's just different. Like, not, you know, it's like you put something out into the world and, you know, people bring their own perspective and
right.
their own history to it.
Right.
And so that's been interesting more than anything else. And then to try to figure out, you know, I guess all writers have to do that too, or most of them, you know, how to get it out there, how to get it to, you know, I think we probably all have this ideal of someone who's going to be pivotal for giving it a wider audience.
Right.
So trying to kind of think about those sorts of things. It's been interesting. Like, I wrote to, there are only, sadly, 14 feminist bookstores in the entire country left.
Wow. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, so I wrote to all of them, and a couple of them said they would order my book on Ingram, and so that was kind of fun, just reading about these feminist bookstores and that they still survive out there, even if there are very few.
Yeah.
But yeah, just looking at some of that, and yeah, just figuring out how to get an audience.
Yeah.
I'm excited, though, because I have all this family in Scotland and Ireland, and they've been ordering the book, so I feel very international. Now.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
And how are people reacting to the book?
People really seem to like it, and they I've been very curious that some people really, or a lot of people, have talked to me about the mental illness aspect of it more than the feminist. Just it being a very, you know, one of my friends in New York is a psych nurse, and he's been a psych nurse for like 40 years, and he called me the minute he finished it, and he's like, this is such a wonderful book to give insight into what it's like to be ill like this and to be so dysfunctional.
Yeah.
And it really is for me the, you know, like Pam says in the book, the delineation. Like, I have, you know, I have these little periods where I, you know, I'm paranoid or I'm depressed. So it's not like I feel like mental illness is that foreign. But yeah, the dividing line is the funk. Can you function or can you not?
Right.
Is it to the extent that you can't function? And that does put you in a whole other circle of hell.
It does.
You know?
Right.
It's very sad. So I've liked that. And, you know, I have ex-colleagues who from the mental health system who praised it. And so that makes me really happy that it's reached some people. They've thought that that's a really, it's insightful. My sister was in this play with this UVM professor, and he wrote to me and asked if he could send copies of my book to, like, the gender studies person, and then I also recommended maybe the psych person. So I'm hoping maybe something will come of that, too.
Oh, great. It's interesting because it has some, I hate to make it sound so niche-y, but it's got, you know, aspects that people will enjoy reading about the feminism, people will enjoy reading about the mental health, and then there's the very personal story and the history of this woman's life and your family, and they just mesh together so beautifully. I have one last question for you.
Sure.
Do you have any advice, having written this book, do you have any advice for people who are trying to write history that is impacted by family or personal history?
When I started writing this book, and it reminds me of the first play I ever wrote, because I have a couple of plays. I wrote it, like, when you actually study playwriting, they tell you, you know, to think in terms of regional theaters doing your play, don't have too many props or too many characters, that sort of thing. And I decided I would pull out all the stops and pretend I was a famous Broadway writer and I could write whatever I wanted. And I just did this very lavish play. And I sort of did that with this, too. Like, it's easy to think, oh, who is this going to upset? Or is this going to be offensive to my parents? And, you know, my sister isn't even in it. You know, like, she doesn't exist.
Did she mind?
She didn't seem to. Maybe she was like, woo, I dodged a bullet. But so I just decided to go for it. And I had some freedom in that, too, because it is a fictionalized account. And, you know, from my aunt's perspective. So, yeah, just to, I guess to be as honest.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I was most concerned with, is trying to get to the honesty of mental illness.
Yeah.
And also women's oppression. And, I mean, all of that stuff is so tied up in my life and my aunt's. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, how, I mean, one of the things about being mentally ill is feeling powerless. And I think as women a lot, we feel powerless. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, there are just all these parallels with so many different aspects of this book, like the child and the abusive parent, you know, all this powerlessness that can lead to, if you don't learn to navigate and find your way out of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for being on Write the Book. The book is Feminist on Fire. The author is Colleen Kieran, and it is published by Fomite Press. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Colleen Kieran. I have to explain that while we were speaking, there was a chihuahua in my lap, and there was a chihuahua next to her on the couch and another one down the couch on the other end. And so some of the sounds that you heard were Colleen's wonderful little family of chihuahuas. They were making little growly noises and snoring and coughing. It was kind of funny. It was very fun. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. You can learn more about Colleen Kieran and her work on her publisher's website, fomitepress.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Colleen Kieran. Open a favorite book to a random page, write down the first three words in any sentence that you see, and then close the book and keep writing using those three words as your new starting point. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule, custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's Trading Post on Facebook. And also by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. I mentioned to Colleen during our interview that she had been in my 100th show and that we are nearing 400 now. In fact, I do believe this is the 370th show. So they are all archived on iTunes. Well, iTunes will let you access the most recent ones, or you can go to the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com, to access any of those 370 podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com, and my co-host Gary Miller's website, garyleemiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont. Thank you. Mm-hmm.